Our first case this morning is 2020-859, the State of Ohio versus James O'Malley. For the appellate, Mr. O'Malley, is Ronald Penoteco, counsel.
Good morning, Chief Justice and other distinguished members of the court, and may it please the court. First off, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if the court will allow. I'd like to start by thanking the court for agreeing to hear this case. This is a case of first impression in this state on both the Eighth Amendment and the 14th Amendment arguments we're going to be making today. Now that the legislature has increased the look-back period for OVIs from 10 years to the previous 6 years, inevitably a lot more people are going to be subject to potential forfeiture. So our hope is today that this court will offer some much needed clarity and guidance to the lower courts and to the citizens of the state on this particular issue. The first issue I'd like to discuss is the Eighth Amendment issues. As the court is aware, in the United States Supreme Court decisions of Bahakasian and Timms, the court gave quite lengthy historical dissertations on the reasoning behind the Eighth Amendment. So viewed in light of that backdrop, plus this court, your court has stated on a number of occasions throughout a number of decades that forfeiture itself, or in general, is a highly disfavored form of punishment. So when we view these Eighth Amendment cases,
just ask you right there. You raised an Eighth Amendment claim, but the Ohio Constitution also has an excessive fines clause. The U.S. Supreme Court case law has not been all that favorable to defendants on excessive fines. Why not? And we've never really developed what our excessive fines clause means. So why not bring a claim under the Ohio Constitution? Why do you stick just to the federal Constitution?
Well, as you mentioned, the law isn't really developed very much as far as the state is concerned, which I think is why the court maybe agreed to hear this case.
But if no one ever raises a state constitutional excessive fines claim, the law will never be developed in Ohio.
I guess you're right about that, Your Honor. But I think the reason why I brought it under the Eighth Amendment is because there has been so much recent activity in the country on the Eighth Amendment with the Ohio Supreme Court, with the state of Indiana and the Timms case, and the body of case law federally on the Eighth Amendment. There's much more to work with than there is in the state of Ohio. There actually isn't very many forfeiture cases, in the appellate courts around the state, which is one of the issues I'm hoping that this decision will address eventually.
Didn't the trial court also consider consider Article 1, Section 9 of the state constitution when it looked at the Eighth Amendment concerns as well? I thought that was part of what was before the trial court.
It may have referenced it.
Counsel, if you can hear me, we're having technical difficulty with you.
Sorry, are you there, Chief Justice?
You froze for the last, we didn't hear what you responded to Justice Bruner.
Oh, I apologize. The trial court's opinion did reference the federal and state case law, it didn't necessarily focus on the Ohio Constitution per se.
But I think what I was trying to get to was, I'm sure you're using the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution because of the plethora of case law there, but because the trial court actually referenced it, I mean, it's something we can deal with if we would want to reference that in our case. I don't think you waived it, do you?
I didn't waive it, no, and you're absolutely right. And as the court's aware, you can provide more protection under the state constitution than even the federal law provides. It's certainly up to the court, and hopefully the court does do that in this case, based on the issue we have on this as applied challenge.
Thank you.
So just to talk briefly about the trial court's opinion, you know, we have a couple of issues with the way the trial court made its decision. First, its reliance on this State versus Zipel case, I think, is very problematic. Number one, because it is so old and it predates most of the new case law in this area, especially with regard to the federal court. It's also very distinguishable on its facts. So that was the case that the court relied on the most and was almost the very first thing the court said in its analysis of this issue. The court also relied on this State versus Kish case, which the court did state that it had a limited multi-factor test that it used. But the Kish case is also problematic for a number of reasons. Number one, in the Kish decision, it states that all of the factors that it listed are essentially equal, that none of them have any more weight than the other. But if we're going to consider at least the federal court decisions in this area, the cases cited in my brief stand for the proposition that some of the factors are going to hold more weight than others. So specifically in the Sixth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit Court has said that the forfeiture to fine ratio is going to hold a lot of weight and perhaps more weight than any of the other factors. So the trial court's reliance on Kish holding all the factors equal would be problematic and erroneous, in my opinion.
Isn't this case a little different than most forfeiture cases, or at least I guess I would think the typical forfeiture case is someone has drugs in a house and the federal government or the state government seizes the house, and you look at what the proportionality obviously matters a lot there, even, maybe transport in a vehicle or whatever. But here, it seems that part of the statute is, or part of the intent of the statute is that this defendant driving a vehicle is dangerous because he continues to refuse to follow the law about drunk driving. And what the statute does is, after so many offenses, it says, okay, we're going to take that dangerous instrumentality out of his hands, regardless of what kind of car he's driving. So doesn't that make this case a little different than some of those other cases where you're really just looking at whether or not the fine is proportional to the considering the harm and what other fine they could have gotten?
Well, at least according to my research on this case, most of the forfeiture cases do involve drug trafficking and major drug trafficking.
Right, they involve major drug trafficking. But the point here is that this involves a vehicle which, at least in the legislator's judgment, is dangerous for the defendant to continue driving because he keeps driving drunk. And that's a little different than just saying, okay, we're going to seize your car because it happened to have drugs in it.
Yes, and that's true. But we need to be mindful of a couple things with respect to the legislature. Number one, on a third OVI, the legislature has made the policy determination that this is still going to be a misdemeanor crime, and it has set the maximum fine at $2,750. So viewing the totality of the circumstances, we need to consider the fact that this is still a misdemeanor, and that fact places some sort of upper limit on the amount of a forfeiture, amount of the vehicle forfeiture, as opposed to maybe a felony. And I cited in my brief the penalty statute for felonies of the first degree, which the maximum punishment is $20,000, or even a forfeiture on a, or I'm sorry, on a felony OVI, the maximum penalty is $10,500. So this forfeiture in this particular case was $31,000. So that greatly exceeds both the felony OVI maximum penalty and the maximum penalty for even a felony of the first degree.
Well, counsel, so you're saying if this car was worth $1,000, we wouldn't be here?
Yes, that's true. The case law has well established that if
I understand that. However, this is the item that facilitates the offense. There's two things that facilitate the offense. One is the consumption of alcohol to the point where your client's impaired, and the other is to get behind the wheel of this vehicle. And as I think Justice DeWine said, the intent was to remove the means by which your client continuously breaks the law and endangers society and himself. And does that nexus and that intent not trump this argument about proportionality of dollars?
Well, the fact that it's a third OBI is certainly a relevant consideration on gross proportionality, but that question is actually a perfect segue into our 14th Amendment argument. And we need to consider.
But before you do that, I mean, that there's been the argument that, okay, there's a suspension of the driver's license, but that obviously doesn't keep him from going to his vehicle. But aren't there intermediate steps before foreclosure, like ignition locks and things that could actually be placed on the vehicle so that he couldn't use it? Yeah, and I'm saying that because now you're going to get into the equal protection argument, and those could be used in either scenario, whether you own the vehicle or not, correct?
Yes, the legislature has given the courts the power to do a number of different things to prevent third OVI offenders or any OVI offender from driving. So we've got license suspensions. The court could order the vehicle to be immobilized in the driveway where it can't be driven. It could order alcohol monitoring. It could order interlock machines, alcohol monitoring devices in the car itself.
Counsel, were they ever employed before for your client?
Yes. So Mr. O'Malley received, number one, he received an administrative license suspension the day that he received his ticket. So right there, that took him off the road. And then once he had pled to the offense, he received a 5-year license suspension. So even
what about in his previous DUIs, was there any interlock or immobilization employed?
Well, on his second OVI, which I believe was quite a few years ago, there was a lot of distance between the
second. Well, we're looking at a 10-year window, so that's what we're stuck with. So
yes, we're stuck with that. But at least on a second OVI now, immobilization of the vehicle is mandatory for 90 days, and a license suspension would be mandatory, and limited driving privileges could only be granted if an interlock machine was installed on the vehicle.
So I asked what happened in the past, though.
Well, I believe he would have been subject to those same penalties.
So he's had an interlock before. He's had license suspensions. He's had these intermediate interventions to no avail.
He has. And, you know, that would be the case for any person who reaches a third or more OVIs. But we have Eighth Amendment implications here on the issue of forfeiture. So there and a policy against forfeiture in this state. So we have to consider that the legislature needs to use alternative means other than excessive fines and forfeitures to prohibit people from committing certain conduct in the future. The Eighth Amendment takes certain policy choices off the table. And in this case, once we reach a forfeiture that's at a certain level, we just can't do it. It's just constitutionally prohibited.
So the forfeiture only goes to the car that was being operated?
Yes, the offender would have had to have been operating the vehicle at the time of the offense, and it needed to be registered in their name.
Nothing stops the individual if they have one other mode of transportation or four other modes of transportation. The state doesn't get to take those.
No, the state doesn't get to take all of their vehicles. So if somebody has two cars, they could certainly choose to maybe break the law and drive under suspension with their second vehicle that wasn't forfeited.
Nothing stops them from buying a second car.
Well, if you are registering,
I understand he can't register, yeah. But nothing stops him from buying a car.
No, nothing stops him from buying it. So I suppose they could drive an unregistered vehicle, which
nothing stops him, absent the license suspension, from borrowing a car and driving it.
That's true. So there's a lot of other means. If somebody's going to break the law, the fact that they got their primary vehicle forfeited is not going to stop them from doing so. So that's one of the arguments I made on the 14th Amendment as to why that's irrational, is because there's so many ways around that law that the forfeiture does not accomplish what the state thinks it's going to accomplish or wants to accomplish.
Well, counsel, do you have any data that would indicate what you're saying? Yes, there may be ways around it, but is there any studies done to show all these alternatives being employed by people who are similarly situated to your client?
I don't have any data on how many people are violating the license, you know, the license suspension laws after they've had a vehicle forfeited. I don't know that data even exists, but we just know that practically speaking, it very easily can be done. And we just talked about a number of different ways that could happen. So I believe
you've used all of your time practically, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Fisher.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the Honorable Court. On July 4th, 2018, at 1:45 a.m. in the morning, the defendant appellant was stopped by a state highway patrol officer for erratic driving, mark lane change violation. He was asked to produce his driver's license and produce the credit card. He did not know his home address and refused a breathalyzer. Subsequently, the defendant appellant pled no contest with a finding of guilt, with the full understanding under the law that the vehicle, the Chevy pickup truck, 2014 Chevy pickup truck, would be subject to a subsequent hearing on possible forfeiture. The court, separate from the no contest plea with finding of guilt, set a separate hearing date for the forfeiture hearing, conducted the hearing with the defendant appellant present with his counsel, full opportunity under due process of law to present evidence and testimony. The court, the trial court, Medina Municipal Court, pursuant to State versus Herald, employed the 7 criteria in State v. Herald and made a determination based upon the totality of all the circumstance, third OVI conviction under the statute with the recidivism provision enacted by the Ohio legislature to forfeit the car. The testimony at the hearing was that the defendant appellant paid $5,000 for the vehicle. He also testified that he put $8,000 of improvement, but there's nothing in the record other than the defendant's testimony to support that assertion. He then testified that the vehicle's worth $31,000 and that knew it was worth $39,000. And again, it's a 2014 truck that is—
wouldn't the state have moved to forfeit if he were driving a $150,000 car? Would the procedures have been any different?
They would not have been different, Your Honor. It would have been the same procedure. And I would strongly suggest that the burden of proof on the defendant appellant at the trial court level was preponderance of the evidence. However, there's no appeal of the trial court's decision that it was against the manifest weight of the evidence or otherwise. Instead, under proposition of law number one, the defendant appellant is contesting the constitutionality of the forfeiture statute as applied, which requires a burden of clear and convincing evidence. So the trial court's decision is not before this honorable court this morning. What is before the honorable court is the constitutional issue as to whether or not the statute on its face is violative of the Eighth Amendment and Article 1, Section 9 of the Ohio Constitution. And I would strongly
Is it your thought that it would be unconstitutional as applied if he were driving a $150,000 vehicle?
I suggest not. That would be a matter for the trial court to take in consideration. And there's several factors, Your Honor, under State v. Herald that were examined in detail. Culpability of the defendant, gravity of the offense, relationship between the property and the offense, harm to the community, the fair market value of the property, intangible and subjective value, and hardship to the defendant. All those criteria.
But arguably, let's say the defendant had a car that was valued $150,000 and it was one of three vehicles he owned. as opposed to a defendant who had a vehicle that was worth, say, $2,500, and it's the only vehicle he owned. I mean, is it evaluated in relationship to, you know, arguably if someone lost this vehicle and it was the only source of transportation to and from work, et cetera, that's a hardship. If someone lost a $150,000 vehicle, that's a financial hardship if you've got two or three more.
Well, under the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, excessive fine provision, if somebody can afford to drive a $150,000 car, then they can afford to forfeit it if they have three OVI convictions in 10 years, at least if the other criteria in State v. Herald are met. I would suggest that obviously the more expensive the car, the greater the disproportionate amount is between the $2,750 fine and the value of the vehicle. But again, it still would be subject to forfeiture under the law as established by the Ohio legislature with a strong presumption of constitutionality.
Thank you.
And again, in regard to Proposition 1, I believe again that it's clear and convincing evidence that the preponderance of the evidence standard at the trial court is not before this court this morning based upon the proposition of law as submitted. In regard to the second proposition of law, equal protection argument, that individuals that don't own vehicles are not subject to forfeiture under the recidivism provision in the Ohio vehicle intoxicated statutes is clearly wrong because, again, there's several examples in the statute of forfeiture separate from ownership, 4511.19 G1C5, also in 4511.203C3C, there's a forfeiture based on registration, which happens many times. If you lease a car, it's often registered in the driver's name. And again, that would also be applicable, as well as negligent entrustment under 4511.203A4. So under proposition of law two, I believe again, the defendant appellant has not met his burden. And again, there is no equal protection argument, or at least valid, I would submit valid equal protection argument, again, of disparate treatment between people that own vehicles versus people that don't. Again, because of negligent entrustment and registration.
Counsel, will you address the point that Justice Bruner had made, that there are alternatives short of a seizure of property such as this, interlock, obviously license suspension, but we all know how well that works, and the other maneuvers or I guess, the conditions that can be imposed by the court on this defendant and others similarly situated.
Yes, there are other alternatives, Your Honor. And I believe again that at least with the second offense based upon opposing counsel's statement this morning, interlock was imposed.
Here's my question about that.
Okay.
How long was the interlock? How long is that, part of the consequence? Is that up to the court?
I'm not able to. I don't know that without. I don't know. I believe so, and I believe also there's the plates that can be placed on the vehicle that again are special plates that indicate right. Again. So
Counsel,
there are
why not
intermediate
just put,
measures, but again,
why not just
I think,
put a boot on the car?
I'm sorry.
Why not just put a boot on the car so it can't move?
Right.
That's a possibility. But again, the legislature has determined that based upon three OVI convictions in 3 years, that there should be a forfeiture proceeding hearing, which is what occurred here. And separately, in regard to this particular defendant, there are three separate disorderly conduct convictions, two of which have an alcohol specification. It's a serious situation. I mean, I've never met this individual. I don't want to speak disparagingly, but the public has a strong interest in keeping people that are intoxicated off the road.
But wouldn't a boot do that?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't a boot on the car do that? Okay. So why not do that?
Again, I can't answer that question. That is a possibility, and it's obviously not as drastic as the forfeiture. But again, this is the third one, Your Honor, within the 10-year period, and based on the recidivism provision that the Ohio legislature has established, there is a forfeiture proceeding. And again, it sends a strong message. Yes, it's harsh. Yes, it's drastic. But again, so is the conduct that is created this situation.
Mr. Fisher, I think that your opposing counsel has only argued this as applied and not on its face. So does that make a difference here?
It makes a difference in terms of the burden, Your Honor. It's clear and convincing as applied.
I understand, but in terms of how this would affect what you do and how this would affect the impact of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that what opposing counsel has done, it's a well-written brief, but he focuses on case law from jurisdictions outside of Ohio. There's much said about an Indiana case. And again, he's focused almost exclusively on the difference between the $2,750 fine versus the value of the vehicle. And I would like to add that the value of the vehicle is not clearly established in the record. And if you look at the court order in number four, the vehicle's value shall be determined by reference to the publication of National Auto Association. There's no real evidence. I'm sorry.
Could we get back though to this constitutional issue? Because if it's a case of first impression, then yeah, he's probably going to argue cases from outside the jurisdiction. So if it's a case of first impression, besides these factual issues, what is the case law that you think should best be used to apply in interpreting this new 10-year statute and how it affects Ohioans based on forfeiture?
I believe it's the case that the trial court used, State versus Herald. And I understand that it's not a horribly recent case, but I think part of the problem with the appeal is that the defendant appellant has no proposition of law with the assertion that the trial court's decision is against the manifest weight of the evidence. Instead, he's made a declaration determination to challenge the constitutionality on its face, which is a different argument, I believe, and a different burden of proof.
I thought we agreed that it's challenging as applied.
It is as applied, but again, I still think that you're not challenging the court's decision and the criteria that he used. And I think that was brought up by the appellate court as well, that it's muddled. And again, respectfully muddled in that the underlying decision, which typically would be challenged based upon manifest weight of the evidence, abuse of discretion, is not before this court this morning, which might allow you to examine the criteria and maybe is the reason why the court, as a matter of great public interest, allowed this case and granted the motion in support of a memorandum in support of jurisdiction, but that wasn't raised here.
So, counsel, are we not to take in the value of the vehicle and relationship to alternatives and other factors here? We're just clearly looking at the words of the Constitution. Is that what you're saying?
I think we're looking at the Constitution. The value of the vehicle is certainly an issue, and it's briefed extensively at 31,000. But right. I would submit again, there is no real finding in the record below as to the value. The defendant appellant paid $5,000 for the vehicle. He claims he put $8,000 of improvements in, but there is no evidence other than his testimony to support that. He claims it's worth $31,000. That's his testimony, but no other evidence to support the $31,000 value he claims.
Counsel, if we're looking at the Constitution, what we're looking at in Ohio Constitution, nor excessive fines imposed. So we do have to take into consideration what's excessive, okay, in relationship to, this individual. When we look at excessive, do we take into consideration the value of the vehicle? Do we take into consideration the effect this has on his ability to make a living and to you know, do other things that are required of an individual living in society with a vehicle and now without a vehicle? Are these all things that we balance in order to figure out whether it's excessive?
Yes, including the culpability of the defendant, the gravity of the offense. Those are all factors, Your Honor, equally considered.
All right, so there are factors.
As it presently exists. I'm sorry.
What about the defendant's income?
He wasn't working at the time of his arrest. He wasn't working several months later when the hearing occurred.
One of the arguments is that the trial court erred by not taking into account his own personal circumstances, the impact it would have on him. Should that something be considered in the analysis?
It's part of the analysis, Your Honor, but I don't believe it was properly raised on the proposition of law, either one or two. The trial court's decision and whether it was supported or not supported by the evidence is not per se before this court. It wasn't raised.
But when we're looking at what the definition of excessive is, I thought you just said we can take into consideration those sort of things.
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's true. But the issue as to whether or not the decision of the trial court should be reversed is not per se before the court. Right. That's all I'm saying, Your Honor. Yes.
I understand that. And we don't even have to go there. I don't know that you get an argument to that. I'm trying to figure out what we take into consideration, trying to determine what excessive is.
I think it's the factors under the current Ohio law. It's the factors, the seven factors that the trial court took in consideration, State v. Herald. That's okay, the case that the trial court relied on. That's where the criteria originate from. And it is an Ohio appellate Ninth District decision. That was relied upon by the trial court. And that's what I believe is the benchmark that the trial court used.
Thank you.
That's before the Kish case, correct?
Your Honor, 1996 is State v. Herald. It may be before Kish. I don't have the date on Kish in front of me. I apologize.
All right. Thank you.
All right, counsel, thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute. You'll have to unmute yourself.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to clarify for a second. The proposition of law number one is an as-applied challenge, which means that we take the facts as the trial court found them and then apply those to the constitutional questions. Proposition of law number two.
Was there evidence about the Did the court find the value of the car to be $31,000?
It did. We presented testimony from Mr. O'Malley, and I believe there were some exhibits also submitted to the trial court, NADA values of the car, and also the state did not have an objection to the $31,000 valuation. So we just look at the transcript from the trial court. So that's not at issue. The value of what the trial court found is not at issue here. We're taking that as it was found, and then we're just applying that $31,000 value to our Eighth Amendment analysis.
Is the stay still in effect on forfeiture?
I'm sorry, is what still in effect?
Is the stay still in effect on forfeiture?
The stay is still in effect. The vehicle is in the possession of the Ohio Highway Patrol pending the outcome of this case. If the court rules in our favor, he would get the vehicle back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.